Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the only podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. Your host, Roberto Mazza, will bring you guests discussing their relationship with the Holy City. A journey through history, society, feelings, and hopes for the future. Follow the podcast on all social media platforms at Jerusalem Unplugged.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. I'm your host, Roberto Mazza, and today it's my great pleasure to host Jalal Aboukater. Jalal is a Palestinian writer, a freelance journalist, and most importantly, is a Jerusalemite. I must say that besides his work, which is fascinating, and his reporting from Jerusalem, one of the things that I cherish the most is that Jalal is a fellow marathon runner. And we will indeed talk about running, and more importantly, running around Jerusalem. Jalal, welcome.
Thank you, Roberto. Happy to be here.
Jalal, the first question is the usual. What is your Jerusalem? In other words, what is your connection with the city?
I think Jerusalem, well, today I would say that I feel a very strong belonging to Jerusalem and I'm always proud of being a Jerusalemite. But this sense of belonging, it came from years of experience, of learning to love the place I'm from. As I grew up, basically, I was very normal, not just in politics. My dad was a journalist. Of course, there are politics in the house, and I know Jerusalem is an old city. My world, my vision was very small, very limited. But I was fascinated by history generally. I was always playing video games, reading books, Roman history, medieval history, castles, walls. History generally was a fascinating subject for myself. And growing up, I started connecting my city of Jerusalem as a central point in many points of like significant points in history. And I understood where Jerusalem stood throughout different periods throughout the past 2000 years. And I felt a growing significance of the city. And that's where my belonging to the city even grew further. My dad being from Silwan, his mother being a Jerusalemite from within the walls itself, and my mother being from Lifta, which the two are like the polar opposites, but the two are the biggest towns around Jerusalem, around the city walls. I felt I was the child of Jerusalem. And it took a few years, I think, of cultivating this belonging. But I feel very proud, and I'm not sure if it's my ego talking, but it's just I feel at the center of the world. Like everyone looks at Jerusalem, whether it's religion or just spirituality generally. I felt like I was very lucky to be born in this city that the whole world looks at. And the holy places and the fact that my grandparents are buried at the cemetery that is literally the closest to what they call the Mercy Gate. We call it Bab al-Rahmeh, which is like the closest place, which I learned that that's where whenever there's the dead will rise after whenever, I don't know. Like those will be the first to be blessed by Christ or the Messiah or whoever is going to be coming back. I just felt like I'm lucky to be from this place, and Jerusalem became a very strong part of my identity as a young person. And honestly, I'm proud of how central it is to many people around the world. And I feel that it helped me create my own personality in a way that I'm just proud to be a Jerusalemite. And I think people are jealous of myself being a Jerusalemite. So that's fair enough.
That's fascinating. A previous guest of a podcast, as a Jerusalemite himself, mentioned the fact that sometimes you would have loved that the holiness of Jerusalem would reside somewhere else. And you use some strong words saying like, I wish God sometimes would just move to another place and keep Jerusalem as a regular city. I was wondering if you ever been bothered by the fact that Jerusalem is also somehow owned by people all around the world, or at least they claim some sort of connection with the city.
It's always been an interesting thing for myself. I think my interest in medieval history, I learned that the first maps of the world were painted in a way where Jerusalem was the very central point in the maps that were the very most ancient maps painted in European history, of course. And I did always, like growing up, I had those thoughts of, for example, like the Jewish people, why are they claiming Jerusalem to be their holy city? And why not just leave it for us and go to another holy place which they have significance? For example, I was just as a kid thinking Saudi Arabia, that's like, there are many Jewish tribes, which I've learned through history studies that they used to live in areas there. Why wouldn't they go elsewhere? Why did they choose Jerusalem? I think growing up, understanding the significance of Jerusalem, in a way, not many people can call themselves Jerusalemites or people who belong to Jerusalem in the sense that I may say that. There are pilgrims who visit all year round. There's Easter, there's Christmas, there's the Jewish holidays, there's a Muslim in Ramadan. It would be very busy without the restrictions of the occupation. But there are pilgrims who visit Jerusalem from the entire world, even people who are not religious oriented, maybe just spiritual basis. They want to come and see and understand why this city holds such significance. And myself being a very spiritual person, I think growing up, I could feel that gravity in Jerusalem, and I could feel it. It's nice to feel like I'm a Palestinian, of course. I'm not a foreigner who moved here just a generation ago. My lineage can be traced back to Jerusalem for hundreds of years, like any other Palestinian Jerusalemite. And that's not something those visitors or tourists or pilgrims have can say, for example. So I'm not annoyed, actually. I'm just happy they would, happy they come visit, as long as they respect us and see us. That's something I sometimes write about. If they come and they see us, the Palestinians of Jerusalem, it's a different relationship with them, of course. What Israel does with the tourism industry in Jerusalem is that come here, take this narrative. It's a very different narrative than what we understand of Jerusalem. The tour groups would, for example, avoid Palestinian areas, avoid Palestinian shops, and just walk over us and then leave. I would love tourists to come and visit my Jerusalem and not the whatever Israel created over the ruins of our Jerusalem.
You open a can of worms, and I probably going back to pick up on some of that. But I just wanted to use what you said to remind also the listeners that as much as I work on Jerusalem, I lived in Jerusalem, I love the city, I know the city, I know how to go around, but I'm not Jerusalemite. And I think this is the big difference between myself and you and all of the other Jerusalemites that have been on the show. There is this sense of belonging, which you can only create when you are in the city and you're from the city. It's different. And I agree with you that, you know, there is a difference and it should be highlighted. There might be a lot of people coming from all around the world. They get to know the city, but still there's something missing there. I picked up something interesting while you were talking, which is a little bit of a Scottish accent. I know you started in Dundee, and that got me thinking about asking you, how was to be a Jerusalemite in Dundee, Scotland? And for many that may not know where Dundee is, it's just north of Edinburgh on the east coast of Scotland, and it's some sort of an isolated small city. I wonder, how did you feel there? How did people react when you were saying, well, I'm from Jerusalem?
Mm-hmm. I'm happy to be talking about this, actually, because when you said you lived in Jerusalem, but you didn't feel that sense of belonging, because I lived in Scotland for 4 years, and I'm a person who's very, like, impressionable. I learn very quickly, and I get involved very quickly. It didn't take me long before landing in Scotland to join forces with the people who are calling for an independence vote, and campaigning with them to get Scottish independence from the UK back then. The campaign was just beginning. I was involved from early days. My friends, sound politics, loved every one of them. They taught me so much. I learned through them, asking questions, experience. The people there are super welcoming. My earliest days in Scotland, I would introduce myself as a Jerusalemite. I'm from Jerusalem. It's hard sometimes to tell people I'm from Palestine. It was like Pakistan or whatever. Like, it's, people don't know where Palestine is. Sometimes, annoyingly enough, I would like, you know, Israel? And they say, yes, Israel. I was like, yeah, that's the same one. It's like, no, they're not next to each other. No, that land that you think is Israel is, to me, is Palestine. And it's a hard thing to explain. And for many in the UK, I think saying Jerusalem is, it's more understandable. It's like, I'm a Jerusalemite. I'm Palestinian Jerusalem. I am from Jerusalem. Very early on, my girlfriend, she was super impressed of the fact that I was a Jerusalemite. She kept telling her parents about this guy I'm seeing, he's from Jerusalem. And they were also excited. Jerusalem, the holy city, the place we always hear about. We want to go to do pilgrimage. We want to go visit. They find it very curious and interesting. It was like, tell us more about Jerusalem. Of course I would. But at the same time, I was also getting myself very involved in being in my Scottish adopted identity. Like, they were adopting me, and I was very accepting of their hospitality. I was very happy to be in Scotland. But the thing that you mentioned earlier about living in Jerusalem, like, I felt a very strong belonging to Scotland. 4 years is not a short time, of course. And I loved whiskey, I loved haggis, and I loved ceilidh dancing. I think there's nothing else that makes you Scottish. Maybe there's plenty. I love the lochs, I love running in the mountains and all that. It was a beautiful country, but at the same time, I knew after the 4 years ended that I don't want to try to even stay here, because I feel like I gained enough experience. I've lived in Scotland, I love this, my second home, but at heart I'm a Jerusalemite. And the fact, I'm not sure if, of course, you know the legal status of Jerusalemites, but I don't have the luxury to live abroad for too long with risking being a Jerusalemite, of losing my blue ID card issued by Israel. And I thought, nothing is worth the risk of losing that. I am a Jerusalemite. I choose to come back here and just live here for as long as it needs me to. I'm happy here. It was a very interesting relationship between Scotland and Jerusalem, but I love both places equally. I think they both had a major influence on my life growing up.
I found it fascinating. And as I said, not only you picked up the accent, but also the Scottish spirit. And I think this is very, very interesting. I'm glad you mentioned the question of the blue ID cards, because this is something in time I discovered not many Israeli actually know about it. They always see Palestinian Jerusalemites as some sort of like, well, you know, they're part of a state equal to Palestinians, citizens of Israel. But that's not the case. This is a unique, I would say, diplomatic and administrative arrangement, but is also highly problematic because, as you mentioned, it doesn't really give you the right to stay away for too long because that status may be revoked. I was wondering if you can just maybe briefly remind us what is the Blue ID?
The Blue ID, of course, most Israelis carry a Blue ID, but when I say blue, I'm distinguishing it from the green and the orange IDs. The orange ID is the one issued to Palestinians in Gaza. The green ID is the one issued to Palestinians in the West Bank. And the Blue ID, in comparison to those two, is the one issued to Palestinian Jerusalemites. For example, I have this blue card that allows me to drive through Qalandia, go to Ramallah, Jerusalem, and back every day, through checkpoints, of course, through the humiliation of a checkpoint, but at least I can travel through. My friends in the West Bank and Ramallah, they cannot, they have to get a permit, for example. I have some sort of freedom of movement. I get coverage from the Israeli healthcare system, which is great. I've got a booster jab as well now, but that's the extent of it. Imagine your entire life being controlled by this document that says you're a temporary, sorry, you're a resident of this place, even though my parents, their lineage goes back to Jerusalem way before the Israeli state was established, but I'm considered a temporary resident of Jerusalem. And as long as I have that card, I can go to Jerusalem and live in Jerusalem. If I live anywhere around, if I go even to Tel Aviv or Ramallah, there's a risk that I may lose that if they sense that I don't have Jerusalem as the center of my life. They created a category of Palestinians in Jerusalem with those ID. We're literally stateless. We have no passport or citizenship to any state. The Israeli state does not recognize us as citizens, of course. We don't have the rights of a citizen in Israel. We do not have any passport of the Palestinian Authority. We're not allowed to, of course. We have a temporary passport from Jordan, as they were the people who controlled Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, before 1967. That temporary passport is meant to ease up your travel, for travel purposes, basically. It does not mean you're a citizen of Jordan or can live in Jordan at all. So we're technically stateless, and the only document that I can carry is that ID. And every day with our entire lives, we've gone through phases of being absolutely anxious, of moments that we could lose this ID. Whenever a stressful moment comes up, whenever there's a tense thing happening outside, or any writing I do or any activism, my parents would say, Jalal, what are you doing? Don't provoke them. Don't talk too much. Maybe they will come and inspect and maybe revoke your ID. The threat of revoking IDs is a threat that every Jerusalemite is fearing every day. And we know of so many people, friends and other families in Jerusalem, who had the state inspectors come and visit and say, okay, maybe your center of life is not Jerusalem. Maybe you have a house elsewhere. And they would take away the right to live in Jerusalem. They would take away their healthcare. They would just send that family to ruins, basically. And the fear is there with every Jerusalemite that we don't know what we could do, what the law is, at what moment they can revoke that ID card. And we become even worse, in a worse situation, being stateless and just having spent so much money on lawyers, on getting some kind of recognition back. So in a way, they've created this category of Palestinians who are always fearful for this document, always worried about losing it, about it being revoked by an Israeli. And there's nothing else we can hold on to. It's not a citizenship. There's no state protecting us. There's just this fact that we are residents of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is, of course, a very crowded and busy city. The fact that we're expected to live our entire lives and our children's lives in Jerusalem is also a bit, it just doesn't make sense, because if I live in Ramallah, for example, or if I live anywhere just 10 kilometers away from the borders of the municipal city of Jerusalem, they can take away my right to go to Jerusalem ever again. My dad's sister and brothers were all Jerusalemites, of course. They got married, they left abroad to Canada, to the States, and they all had their IDs revoked because they left the country. A few years later, they tried to come back, like, no, you come back with a visa and not with an ID card. So anyone who lives here for a year or two can risk losing that entire identity part of their character.
You've been away for 4 years. I've been abroad. I left Italy 20 years ago, but obviously, you know, no one's going to stop me if I want to go back. But yeah. On the other hand, if you want to, whether it's for professional, personal reasons, you need to make choices which are very different. And you have to include also, you know, the question of a blue ID.
I was away for 4 years, but I had to come back every summer, of course, for a month at least to prove my presence. And when I came back after my studies, I think during my studies, I tried to renew my ID card. It was becoming the old version. They wanted a new version. I went to the Ministry of Internal Affairs, the Israeli ministry, and they said, why are you away for so long? What are you doing wherever you are in Scotland? And I was like studying. I was like, okay, so you can't get an idea and you will until you come back and bring your degrees and sign the paper that you've done with your studies. You're completely done. And I had to come back after my studies in Dundee with my degree in my hand and show the officer, like, look, I got my degree. I'm back. I'm going to stay here. I'm not going anywhere. I was like, are you sure? I was like, yes. And then, okay, they gave me a renewal for the ID card. It's just humiliating, really.
Jalal, you've been a guest on a numerous, I would say, news outlets, BBC, CNN, Sky News. And so this brings me to your job as a freelance journalist. How does it feel? What does it mean to be a freelance journalist, someone reporting stories from Jerusalem, particularly from a Palestinian background?
In Jerusalem, I feel I've grown an experience in this field, especially in journalism and mostly written journalism in the English language. And I always recognize that there's a lack of Palestinian journalists in Jerusalem who are reflecting a day-to-day life, reflecting what's happening on the street. In many cases, the stories that get reported from Jerusalem, the stories we get to see in the mainstream media are always reported by a foreign journalist or an Israeli journalist who comes to Ramallah or to Jerusalem or reports about a story. Not local Palestinians. The local Palestinians are not really, don't have enough space in the mainstream media to tell their stories. I felt like cultivating my experiences over the years, I felt I was learning how to navigate this super tricky maze of how to talk about Palestine and not be conceding to any false narratives or narratives that I don't wish to engage in. I'm a very proud Palestinian Jerusalemite. I'm very proud of my identity. And in the past, they made it very difficult for us to speak freely of what we think and what we believe. Sometimes they always want to ask us like, okay, one state solution, two state solution, what do you think? And I'm like, I don't really care. I just, this is my Palestine. Those are my people. And we're everywhere. And we need our rights. We need our this. And whatever solution you come up with has to guarantee that at least those rights are there. And solutions are not really the concern of us Palestinians, especially in Jerusalem, because we're always at the center point of whatever negotiations or events. Like there would be a scandal with the PA would be negotiating something, and then Jerusalem is the point of contestation that breaks everything down, for example. Or there would be any flare-up in violence or anything, and there's always Jerusalem at the center point of everything. So I thought this last period, this year, I felt empowered enough with others, of course, in Jerusalem, that we are the ones who always say what we want freely. We want to speak our minds. We want to report factually. We want to reflect the stories of our own people in Jerusalem. We don't wish to be viewed from the lens of other people's writing or other like foreign journalists reporting. We are on our own, are capable of reflecting our stories. And we all empowered each other by literally being uncensored and going to those media outlets and speaking our minds and saying we're unapologetically Palestinian. This is how we think. This is what we say. And if you don't take us, you're literally silencing our views. And I don't know, it's about time people listen to us, and especially in Jerusalem. And I felt this has been more demonstrated this year than ever before when you heard Jerusalemite voices. And I just really want to highlight how amazing the twin sisters, Muna and Muhammad al-Kurd, have been. Muna for the Arabic audience and Muhammad for like the English listening audience, both incredible in their own means, unapologetic in their narratives, and very honest and concise, and don't really fear a Zionist a backlash towards what they say, because we're humans, we have dignity. Why should we be worried about someone else's feelings if we're the ones who are always trampled upon? So it's about time that we speak freely, and I felt empowered by this wave recently. And I really took in that moment whenever I would be invited to speak on a TV station or invited to speak on a radio, for example. I would be speaking my mind and saying, this is a Palestinian Jerusalemite speaking, and you better hear it. that's what you want. This is what we think.
As a Jerusalemite growing up in modern-day Jerusalem, you're also fluent in Hebrew. I was wondering if you ever thought about...
Kind of, right?
But I was wondering if you ever thought about trying to interact with the Israeli audience too. One of my major issues that I discovered in time is that plenty of Israelis don't really know much about Palestinians, because essentially the Israeli media don't really talk about Palestinians other than in a very negative way, or using certain tropes, or about, you know, terrorists, or they, whether they may be. So without really providing a clear picture. And I was wondering if you feel like, you know, the next step would be perhaps to, you know, for Palestinians to encroach into the Hebrew language and say, look, this is who we are. And now we're also telling you this in your own language.
Very interesting question. And for me, I don't think it's my next step, as it was probably one of my earliest steps. And I felt that it really helped form myself, my views about so many things of the issue, to understand more of the Israeli society. I think in 2011, when my political awareness was just being built, I did have some Israeli friends, Israeli journalist friends, well, considered friends, people I would talk to. At the beginning, I was, of course, very naive about so many topics and subjects. I was invited to write for a few Israeli outlets, and in the English language, of course. I did comment about some Israeli protest movements. I think my first two pieces were about the peace marches that happened in Jerusalem, I think 2011, perhaps. I participated in those marches, and I saw Israelis with signs calling for an end to the occupation and for a Palestinian state. There's like the leftist Israelis, liberal Zionists among the crowds. A lot of people would be walking through those marches and groups. Later on, there was the protest movement in Tel Aviv. I think it was called J14. And I still felt very engaged with the Israeli political activism scene. I wrote a couple of other pieces, like a letter to those activists. And I was like hoping, like, you should address the occupation. You should address this. Those are like major issues. Perhaps if you think the economy is doing bad, perhaps there's a problem that you should focus on the military spending, the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. And that should concern you as economic activists. Social equality or whatever. That was like not my next step. That was my very first early days. And I owe it to some friends as well who were talking to me then and saying, okay, so this outlet, like liberal Zionists, what are they? And I was like understanding very early on, like, they're really not interested in your welfare in that sense. They just want to guarantee a future of Israel to be a Jewish state. And the current policies of occupation, prolonged occupation, would threaten their vision of a Jewish state next to a Palestinian state, for example. The reason they fight, not all of them, of course, but like Zionism in a way, it took me a while back then to understand, is like a Zionist is a Zionist, and Zionist ideology does not really accept a Palestinian being from Palestine. I claim I'm a Palestinian, I'm from Palestine. The Zionist ideology itself does not really welcome that person, myself. And I felt if this is an exclusionary ideology, then I'm really against it. And there's no way to reconcile myself with this ideology. And that was like early days of my political ideas being formed. And I think throughout university, I met Israelis as well. And later on, I engaged with more Israelis doing travels abroad and stuff. I think I had formed my understanding of Israeli society very early on. And there are some things that really, it's not about dialogue or engagement. It's just about, they really choose not to see us, because if we talk, whenever we engage, there's always that point that it's just dead end. It's a locked conversation. Like, I want to live here with dignity. And they were like, but we can't have you over. This is a Jewish state. We can't have you all here. I was like, you came, like, it's just a dead end conversation. And the fact that I learned it early on was very helpful for myself to be able to engage very normally and in a civil way with most Israelis that I meet throughout my time. And I would always love to discuss what they think of their identity. Are they a Zionist, Israeli, or do they see themselves as a dwellers of a city, for example, of Tel Aviv, rather than Israeli itself, or a Zionist liberal? To engage with the Israeli Hebrew media, it's literally, I don't think it's anyone's job, not mine, and I don't think the energy should be from us to do that. Like, I feel like that's a counter to the where our energy should be spent. I think our energy should be spent on ourselves first and foremost, to be able to at least speak to each other and debate and discuss and understand our aspirations more than just talking to the Israelis, because there is always chances. It's just themselves. They don't want to engage or understand or open their eyes to the fact that we're all here. They'd rather just like shove under the carpet, ignore for now. The problem will be solved later. They're living a very luxurious life. I go to Tel Aviv like all so often, and I go, I have the freedom of travel, of course. So I can see, understand their lifestyle, and I'm with them and among them in Jerusalem all my time, all my life. I see the world they live in. I just choose not to engage because I feel like I'm not really welcome, and they're not going to be welcoming me. I'm not a guest here. I'm a Palestinian. And it's like, oh, you're Palestinian. That's so interesting. It's like, no, don't do this to me. So it's just a thing that I think I moved past early on. Today, I speak to those who are willing to speak, of course, those who are willing to understand, to see each other as equals, as equal human beings, not that get away from me. Just, yeah.
I feel that what you said about the choice not to see the other is a key point. As you mentioned at the very beginning of the interview, like Israeli policies, you know, implemented by the Ministry for Tourism to take tourists essentially through certain routes that avoid, you know, any contact with Palestinians is then reflected in, you know, at large in the very same choice not to see the other. And I think this is an important aspect, which I personally also chose to highlight more and more in the podcast, because I feel like we talk about Jerusalem, but many, many people, far too many people, are always looking at one side of Jerusalem, and they, you know, mentally depopulated, you know, the Palestinian side, and that's wrong. It's literally wrong. And I don't know if you're aware, but there's certain Instagram accounts that, you know, keep posting pictures of Jerusalem. You know, these are very popular Instagram accounts. They do gather, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of followers, but essentially, you know, the Palestinian component, it's always neglected. And it's interesting because whenever they post pictures related to Christian sites, then it becomes international, you know, and the local component just simply disappears. And so I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I think it's important to highlight that it's a choice. It's not random. It's not the byproduct of, you know, culture and society, but there is a choice not to see the other. Yeah. And this brings me to ask a question. You're a storyteller. And you certainly talked about, and you've been very vocal about Silwan, Sheikh Jarrah, Lifta. But I also was wondering if you ever come, you know, you come across stories that might be little known outside Palestine, outside Israel, but that you would like to tell, you know, our listener.
I think that the most interesting thing, sorry, I had a call a few days ago. I'm just recovering and still there. With the story of Sheikh Jarrah and the media attention that it had gathered from around the world, people were just looking. It was like ethnic cleansing in Jerusalem. What is that? And people were just literally tuning into Palestine for the first time to see what's happening in Sheikh Jarrah. This was a very significant thing that happened this year. And I just remember to ask my dad, it was like, Dad, we have a house in Western Jerusalem in Qatamon neighborhood, right? Like, can you tell me more about this? And I was like, of course, I can give you all the papers, I can give you all documents, and you carry on the task of fighting for this house. And it was a very exciting like moment for myself, because it's like I just opened Pandora's box. I was asking my dad about our family history in Jerusalem, his uncles, how and why they lived in Beit Hanina and not Silwan in the 50s. I later understood that their house in Silwan was lying near Zion Gate in Bab al-Nabi Dawood, we call it. And that was the area that became the ceasefire zone. And they had to leave the houses back then in 48. So between 48 and 67, they had to leave to go to Amman and then back to Jerusalem. They lived in Beit Hanina in the 50s. I learned a lot of interesting aspects about my family. The fact that I have my dad's uncles who went to Nicaragua, those who were Sandinistas, and the other was pro-government. I don't know, it's just like a lot of history of my family was just coming out from the fact that my grandpa owned a house in Qatamon neighborhood. And that specific story, I was like, I would go to work every day, I would speak to my friends, I would see people discuss this house, discuss those ideas, and then I would hear more stories of more Jerusalemite families, and I would learn more about the Jerusalemite neighborhoods in West Jerusalem, mostly Musrar al-Baqa, Qatamon, Talbiya, where families, full families, were just living there before 1948. And how they had been forced out of their homes. Even the families which chose to stay for longer and longer were eventually forced violently out of their homes. And I have papers that show my grandpa's name as a purchaser in the 30s. And then suddenly there's this gap, and the Israeli land authority is selling this house to some, I don't know, undisclosed side. And the same papers I have in my hands, like I'm looking here, it's like how did this happen? Learning about the laws that they created to steal our property. It's like, okay, so they're coming to Sheikh Jarrah to claim that they have property and they have the deeds for something from the 1800s or 1900s. And they are doing a whole court case, and the Israeli state is really thinking that they will succeed. And we all understand that the Israeli state, that's how it functions. It will succeed. Those agencies that are fighting for taking those homes from the Palestinians have a stronger agency at the Israeli court system to actually take those properties as if they were once owned by Jews, and now they go back to Jews. But at the same time, West Jerusalem is filled with houses, thousands of them, that we Palestinian families still have deeds for. And we have the old papers from the Turkish documents, the British documents, Jordanian documents. We have so many papers that prove ownership of those houses. And we can go there, we can take pictures of the house, we can recognize exactly where it's located. Of course, you just need some visual memory from older people. But there are so many houses that belong to us that were literally stolen by the law of absentee property that they created in 1951. And they are still doing court cases, that Supreme Court trying to take those houses in East Jerusalem. And it just felt like they keep claiming that Jerusalem is a unified city, but at the same time, there are two sets of laws, one for the Jewish population, one for us, for the Palestinians. And I thought this should be my focus for a while. And I did just go very deep in this topic, I think near July, August, like June, July, I think mainly. I thought, like, if they really want to ethnic cleanse Sheikh Jarrah and kick those families out of their homes, then they should be setting a precedent for their own legal system that would allow the thousands of Palestinian families in West Jerusalem to reclaim their houses back. Even, for example, Al-Kurd family, they would claim their house in Jaffa back as well, in Jaffa. And Palestinians, you know, have been kicked out of homes violently through force in many, many cities and villages around Palestine. Of course, there are other cases of settlement being built on public land or different cases, but we have deeds that show our properties. So why not just bring more attention to this idea, this fact that they are using the Supreme Court, the legal system, to do this in Sheikh Jarrah, but at the same time, We should be able to do that, to our own properties on the other side, but they're not letting it. Like, that is apartheid. That is a racist system that is not really legally dependent at all. And I don't know, it's just, I felt like more people should know that this is the case. Those houses are not Jewish houses, not Jewish neighborhoods. They became Jewish neighborhoods after the Israeli state legalized the theft of those homes. What makes that right? And whatever happens, yashallah wrong. Like, it's just it's a very wide topic. But I think throughout July, I felt I connected with more people, spoke with more people in Ain Karim, for example, and I heard stories of people who were successful enough who actually managed to reclaim houses in West Jerusalem. I went to Iqrit in the north with a friend from, she was from Kfar Yassif. Her parents are both from Iqrit. So this is a Palestinian Christian village in the north. Her mom is from Tarshiha and dad from Kfar Yassif, but both hail from Iqrit. That's where both parents had to leave after 48. I learned more about the military court orders, how they destroyed the villages. I keep going to those places where in Palestine, where like there's a national park now built by the KKL, the Jewish JNF, the Jewish National Fund. I was like, okay, this is a park. Let's just find the traces of Palestinian existence. And I would find this well, this house that was destroyed, the cactus tree and all that. I feel like people should know that we really, really, really exist everywhere, and we have the papers for it, and everything their state is built upon is a lie and just theft. And if they really want to kick us out from Sheikh Jarrah, we can do the same thing to kick them off everywhere that they claim is theirs. That's literally the same game they're playing. It's just that they don't want us at all to be in Palestine, and that's a big problem.
You mentioned earlier a Kurd family sort of did a very good job in publicizing the case of Sheikh Jarrah around the world. I mean, the use of a very good English, synthetic, up to the point, with a very clear vocabulary, drove the attention of many that didn't know much about Sheikh Jarrah. But you're right. I mean, when you look at the history of a city and you think about places like Katamon, which used to be this very wealthy mixed neighborhood before 1948, and then obviously all the Palestinians' family were kicked out. Yeah, mm-hmm. Nowadays there is an amazing project, Jerusalem, We Are Here, which is essentially a website that allows people to use the technology of Google Maps and find their own old houses. This was by Dorit Naaman, who's an Israeli activist, and she worked with other Palestinians. But that doesn't give people the real sense of a house. It's only a way of connecting with those properties and obviously to revive memories, like you mentioned, of your own family. Despite the fact that there are papers and, you know, those papers could give effectively back properties, but it doesn't happen because this law, and reinforced by a 1970 law, which we talked about many times here on the show, essentially discriminates. So Jews can actually claim back properties, but Palestinians cannot. So here we are. We've a segregated, and you use the right word, an apartheid system in place. We're reaching the end of the interview, but I really want to talk about your passion here, which is running. First of all, I wanted to ask you, what was your last long run? And then I want to know about running in Jerusalem. How does it feel? How is it to run across the borders, the invisible borders of the city of Jerusalem?
My last long run, I think 20 kilometers, is that a long run or a marathon, are you asking? Because my last marathon was in Malta. I was studying in Malta, I think, last year, and training for the marathon, I would run the entire island. It's that small. And the marathon itself was quite fun because you're just doing laps around the whole island. It's a very small place. Last year, I think, yeah, in March, just before COVID hit, like that week where like it's Italy and China were not allowed to participate in the marathon. Anyone who had a boarding pass from Italy was like, okay, bye-bye. But that was the last marathon before COVID actually hit. I did a 20 kilometer run just last, was it Yom Kippur? Last week, two weeks ago. I thought Yom Kippur is a perfect day to run in West Jerusalem. usually I do run on Saturdays. I go up in the morning. I run around the empty streets of like Western Jerusalem mostly. But Yom Kippur was a very special day because I was like, okay, I'm going to run in my Jerusalem. And I did a run from my house in Beit Hanina and then just went straight to West Jerusalem and then just zigzagged throughout all the neighborhoods, like just enjoying this morning. It was like no cars, no people, no vehicles, nothing. The weather is great. No Israelis inside. I'm just like running through Jerusalem and having a blast. It's not something I usually enjoy to run in Jerusalem. It's first of all, it's a very busy city. It's very crowded. And my mom doesn't think it's safe. She was like, why are you running in Jerusalem, Jalal? What if they know you're Arabic? He's like, no, I don't think they think people like me run. So it's okay, I'm safe. And she always fears for my safety, of course, in Jerusalem. That's been a concern for years now. Like whenever I'm there alone, she would be worried, like, don't speak Arabic, don't do this, that, because of course there's a history of violence towards Palestinian Jerusalemites in Jerusalem. And I told her, like, mom, don't worry, I'm safe. West Jerusalem, they have some good infrastructure for running. They've invested in that because they enjoy running too. But for myself, I just don't really enjoy it. I'd rather, for example, run with a running group in Ramallah. Sometimes I go to Jaffa to run across along the seaside, if the weather permits. Of course, in summer it's just impossible. Even at 6 a.m., humidity is like insane. So most of my running is done usually in the West Bank, in Ramallah, where I feel it's like fresh air, it's nice. I've got a running group. We're called Right the Movement. We are the ones who organize the marathons and in Bethlehem and all that. And in Jerusalem, my favorite trail, we do it like once or twice a month. We go to Sataf. It's the location of a destroyed village, 1948. This is genuinely a beautiful trail. The Sataf village is next to Suba village. It's just, I think, towards southwest of Jerusalem. It's like a 10-minute drive. It's very remote. And we're running on this mountain in a circular loop for 8 kilometers, the whole loop. And it's just very nice to be out in, like, literally outdoors, but still in Jerusalem. And there's nothing around us except trees, of course. Those trees are covering the ruins of Palestinian villages, but we always keep repeating that we're running in Sataf, we're running in this location, or Lifta, for example. There's a path in Lifta as well that we run through. Those are the nice runs. In the city itself, it's hard, but it's nice that we have a group of Palestinian runners, Right Movement, and we organize runs in Lifta or Sataf very often. And then we have social gatherings too in the same area. So we finish our run, we're all finished, then we gather some wood and lumber, and then we make shakshuka for a morning breakfast. That's the tradition we always do as well. It's like, if you want to run with us, sure, come run, but you'll have a treat after. So make sure you run well, you break sweat. But yeah, mostly if I'm running, it's not in the city of Jerusalem. If I'm running within the city, it's just not safe. It's annoying. It's super crowded. And I don't think I've ever enjoyed running as much as I did in Dundee in Scotland. Just running around the riverside for like 2, 3 hours, 4 hours, and then not interrupted by any checkpoint or anything. Here I have to calculate and have every checkpoint, every border wall. It's like doing laps in Ramallah, for example. We're just doing laps around each other, like in circular loops, trying not to downhill and uphill. It's very like mountainous, hilly, the areas here. But we work with what we've got. This is what we've got. The Israelis have some other different world, of course, for running and outdoor activities, but I'm not part of that society. So I wouldn't be going to their towns and cities to run. I just don't feel comfortable enough to do that. So I'd rather stick to my East Jerusalem or Ramallah or just Jaffa.
I always found Istanbul the worst place where I lived for a run. But I must say that in the years I lived in Sheikh Jarrah, on top of a hill, running was hard. And yes, yeah. I joined a few people running in Ramallah too. But I mostly end up running on a treadmill at the YMCA down, you know, close by to the old city. Not exactly the best, but at some point it became the only way. I mean, between the traffic, the people, and mm-hmm. and I remember there were a few international work, you know, just people working in the various consulates up in Sheikh Jarrah. We went for a few runs, but never really felt it was like, can we say a runnable city? I don't even know if this word exists, but
it's very hard. Yeah.
But I do share what you said about it. I have one question about running. You know, I lived in many parts of the world, and many times I run in the wilderness, and I've been chased and bitten by dogs. But last June, I think it was a first, you were running this, let's say, walk mm-hmm. between Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan, part of the Save Sheikh Jarrah and Save Silwan movement, and you were beaten at the finish line by Israeli forces. How that happened?
That's a bit insane, actually. The whole event, how it unfolded. As you know, I think around that time there was the movement of Save Sheikh Jarrah, and then Save Silwan was like just emerging as like a hashtag, because Silwan families and friends, they thought we have opportunity to highlight our struggle as well. You know, Silwan has been struggling for years with demolitions and house evictions and all that ethnic cleansing, forms of ethnic cleansing. So when Sheikh Jarrah took the limelight, both areas, both activists from both Save Sheikh Jarrah and Save Silwan thought, let's get people to know and connect both areas. And the best way they thought about it was doing a run in Jerusalem, because Sheikh Jarrah was popular with the people, with the visitors, with the people who were just learning about Sheikh Jarrah for the first time. The location is easy to find, I'm sure, you know, on a main street just south of Jerusalem, the old city. Sorry, north of Jerusalem, the old city. And Silwan, we know Silwan, we know where it's located, but as you said, it's a very crowded place. It's town, I mean, and it's very small streets that people don't really go if they don't really have to go to Silwan. So it's a very, very good point that they actually tried to get people to come from Sheikh Jarrah. The crowds would always go to Sheikh Jarrah to go to Silwan through this organized run in a very simple route. And that's how you get more solidarity and more people to actually see what's going on in Batn al-Hawa neighborhood. You can see and learn about the house evictions and the ethnic cleansing that goes on in Silwan. You can connect both areas, both neighborhoods, Batn al-Hawa and Sheikh Jarrah, through the same lens. And it was a very spontaneous thing. There's a thing, I don't think the Israelis were expecting us to actually do a run. They know we are active, we have sports clubs, we run, but it's not as popular as you can imagine. But this run, I think it took them by surprise. They just saw people gathering. And when I arrived at Sheikh Jarrah, I was very excited. Like, I was part of what's going on. I was always attending the events. It was like a run, Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. This is my call, my calling. I have to do this. And I just got put on my shirt from Tokyo Marathon a few years ago. It has it has the Right Movement logo on the front, Right Movement Palestine. And I just told my friends, okay, see you soon. I'm just gonna run. It's just like a very short run, 3.5 kilometers. That was it, to connect from Sheikh Jarrah to Silwan. Of course, I noticed in Sheikh Jarrah itself, there's a heavy Israeli police presence, and they were just like taking photos and zooming in and out. The Shabak officer is like telling the police officer, like, take a photo of that guy, this guy. What are they doing? What are they up to? And of course, we were very, I think, in a way, discreet. Everyone was just given a white t-shirt, and then it's like, okay, guys, run. The route is this. You go from here to Bab al-Zahri and then down, and then you just go down to Silwan through the... I forgot what's it called, that path. But it was a very easy route, and everyone's like, okay, cool. People just went on, and runners like myself were at the front. And most people were like running, walking, running, walking, running, walking until they made it there. It's not too far. When we arrived at Silwan, Batn al-Hawa, of course, for many people, it was the first time to arrive in the protest tent in the very, very heart of Silwan. This is like, we call it Al-Har al-Wusta, the very central neighborhood, Batn al-Hawa. And of course, the situation there is dire, but it was a scene that we would have never imagined before. It wasn't just people from Silwan, it was Jerusalemites, Palestinians, all gathered in the very heart of Silwan. And it was a very celebratory mood. There was music being played, water given out. It's a race that finished in Silouan. And they were so welcoming. It was like, welcome Silouan, and everyone's happy. I was like, I'm from Silouan myself. I'm a Silouani guy, but I've never lived in Silouan. But I'm still like always telling people I'm from Silouan. It was a great day. My sister was there. My friends were there. I had a friend with a puppy as well. Not a puppy. It's a big dog, but it's a very, you know, small size, but not older than a puppy. Just seeing friends and casually chatting and taking pictures and singing with the music. And it was a party, literally a party. And I thought, this is amazing. I'm so glad no one interrupted it. I was just expressing my happiness that I can't see any Israeli police officer in this area. And it's fair enough. It's a very central Arab Palestinian neighborhood and there's no reason for them to show up. And then just out of nowhere, it's like, oh my God, why are they coming in? Like a big bunch of them, like a dozen maybe. Just walked right through the crowd, like pushing people right through the crowd, going to the tent. I think they were to confiscate the speakers and the sound system. And I was like, if they never showed up, we would have just gone home peacefully and that's the end of the story. We had a good run and we're done. The same riot police officers who would be seen in Sheikh Jarrah, who were beating us every night for the past few weeks, they were the ones who were there as well. Like I could recognize faces and feel command. You know, the Shabak guy that always goes, the chief of the police, and it's like the same angry people who are beating us there, they brought them in here to do the exact same thing in Silouan. And it just all felt too connected, to be honest. As soon as they walked in, they felt like there's people are protesting. Why are you here? And that's when they started throwing stun grenades into the crowd. You know, people are not expecting a police response or in this shape and this violence. There was some chaos and people were running around, escaping. I was like, I just took out my phone. I was like, this is just unreal. Like, why are they coming in here? I think they just got even angrier and angrier and just started rushing towards people like, leave now, leave now. And they're just hitting us with batons, like, just stop, don't beat me. And I'm in my full running gear and they're just hitting me once, twice, three times. And then it just went super insane, really. I think after I got beaten the first time, I tried to take shelter in the tent. Like I went back to the tent to take shelter. The police went up to chase people around the neighborhood. And then they came back again. And like they were shouting at us from afar. It was like, we're saying, like, we're just taking shelter here. Like, just leave us alone. And they didn't like us still being there. So they rushed towards us again and started beating us again. Of course, I had all that documented in my thread on Twitter.
I have one last question. You're very young, talented. I was wondering, what are your, you know, future projects?
I love writing. I think I always think I have so much to say through writing. I read a lot of novels, philosophy. I'm a very spiritual person. I have my own views of how I see life, view life, and I think I always have like a unique story to tell. Just I need to get myself to be bit more focused, to be honest, but I see myself as a writer who writes good things. I don't know the extent of that is, but I just want to be able to reach to more people through very unique and different personal stories, to be honest. Personal fiction, perhaps, I don't know, but just want to write to tell my own personal perspective to people.
While we wish you good luck with that. This was Jalal Aboukater that you can follow on jalalaboukater.com or the various social media accounts, particularly on Twitter and Instagram. Jalal, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Roberto. Thank you for having me. This was enjoyable.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please share it with others on social media or leave a rating and review. To catch all the latest, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Jerusalem Unplugged. Thanks, and I'll see you next time.
Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.